Welcome to Highly Sensitive Money. I'm your host, Diana Giselle Yáñez, and I invite you to embark on a journey with me, a journey where spirituality intertwines with the complexities of wealth. In a world where material possessions often define our worth, Rose Furyk's upbringing in an affluent yet spiritually grounded environment led her down a path of introspection and transformation. Now she shares her story, a story of navigating paradoxes, seeking harmony, and discovering the profound connection between money and the mystical heart. Rose Furyk grew up in a family that emphasized kindness, ethics, integrity, and generosity. As a young adult, she decided to simplify her lifestyle and work to support low-income women who were seeking stable housing and medical care. About the same time, she received the unexpected gift of a financial portfolio. The paradox of that moment awakened questions related to wealth, spiritual wisdom, and social justice. Rose has been offering retreats related to money and Christian spirituality since 2003. She has a BA from Georgetown University and an NDiv from the Jesuit School of Theology of Santa Clara University. She lives in Santa Cruz, California, and is delighted to be the mother of two young adult sons who share her love of music, nature, and conversation about stuff that matters.
Thank you so much, Rose, for coming on to this first season of Highly Sensitive Money. I'm thrilled to get to interview and to have this conversation on money and social justice.
Thank you for inviting me. Thank you for doing this. I'm a huge fan, great supporter of everything you are, Diana.
So Rose and I met in 2021, I believe. Mm-hmm. We met at a retreat that you were hosting for Wisdom and Money. It was an at-home retreat because this was in high COVID times. What really attracted me personally to Wisdom and Money is at the time I was working at a very traditional investment advisory firm. Most people were coming from a place of like, how do I get as much as I can? How do I keep it? And Wisdom and Money was like, how do I live in the spirit of flow? It was a completely different language. I'd love to hear how you describe Wisdom and Money to people who are not familiar with it.
Yes, great question. Well, Wisdom and Money is a network of people who have a common experience of finding ourselves with more than enough money. We have an awareness that that is our state, or we are people who come from a culture of wealth, by which I mean maybe we come from a wealthy family, or maybe we are working with wealth in our jobs. Somehow we are people who have a relationship with wealth. We're also people who are deeply committed to the spiritual journey and to the well-being of all people. The question that a lot of people share when we come into Wisdom and Money is, what do I do with this? How do I think about money? How do I engage with money in a way that feels like it's honoring of the well-being of everyone and that it's connected to spirit? So our organization, it's really a network of peers, and what we do is create spaces where people can honestly, openly, authentically ask the questions that we have related to wealth and how it can flow in service of goodness for all people, including ourselves.
Yeah. And I love that, the distinction that it's a network of peers. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I always enjoy about, and full disclosure, I'm a member of Wisdom and Money. I'm in one of the circles, which is a smaller intimate group that continues to carry these questions for an undefined amount of time. Mm-hmm. It's always when you're facilitating, when other staff at Wisdom and Money are facilitating, it's participant facilitation, this transparency that's happening that is so unlike most spaces, and even more so when it comes to money, because in money it's often so hierarchical. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I don't see hierarchy at Wisdom and Money sometimes, which can sometimes feel chaotic. Mm-hmm. How do you manage introducing people to this different way of doing money?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of ways in which what we're doing is different, and the way we facilitate is one of them. The simplest way is to say that we're inviting people into a community which has a particular way of being together. And so that way of being includes, we talk openly about money. we engage in certain spiritual practices together, which are contemplative in nature. And we also train everybody in particular ways of speaking and listening in this particular community, how we do it here. And so we take, you know, I understand in my job as a staff member that a lot of what I'm doing is welcoming people into community and then helping them to understand just how things roll here or the particular culture of this community, because it is a very different way of being together, particularly around money. So that, like you said, there's a lot of spaces related to money that are hierarchical in nature. There's a lot of power dynamics that can play out around money. There's a lot of ways that people like me who are not financially trained can feel like, I don't know how money works. And that's actually how the system is set up. And so what we're doing is we're saying, hey, we're intelligent beings. We learned many things in our lives. And we have soul-centered questions. So what if we give ourselves space to ask those questions, to trust that we can learn what we need to know along this path? We will know when we need to ask professionals for support. But fundamentally, what Wisdom and Money is a community of practice, a community of peers, people who see that money is a really important part of our lives, and it's also a pretty amazing way that we can participate in transformation, both of ourselves and of the world. So it's a very juicy topic in that way, in that it can flow, you know, it can be part of the change we want to see, again, in my life as well as in the world. So the place that makes that possible is when we have friends for that journey. So that's what Wisdom and Money is doing, is creating ways for us to meet other people who have these questions and to learn ways we can be together that are truly supportive. So that's our goal. And I would just say, when people come to us, I understand that there it takes a bit of time just to get oriented to any new culture. And so Wisdom and Money has a particular culture that we introduce people to. And people generally know if it's for them or if it's not. And that's fine. You know, we have a particular thing that we are offering, and it's a good fit for some people, and it's okay if it's not for others. So it's like that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And for myself, I mean, I come from someone who's been meditating on and off for a decade. I'm a Quaker, so we do a lot of contemplative practices, which is a lot of sitting, waiting, opening up. It's a lot of being with other people and exploring what comes up in the moment. So I think people coming from contemplative spaces that come into Wisdom and Money are probably going to feel very rooted and comfortable and familiar. It's more of when you're coming from money spaces, mm-hmm. coming into Wisdom and Money, it can be a bit of a shocker, because again, one of the things that I enjoy so much about Wisdom and Money is what you've said many times, it's the community. Mm-hmm. It's knowing that there's someone there with me as I'm learning about a different aspect of myself when it comes to money. I love our slogan, money as a doorway to transformation.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's and it.
And I've seen how that happens. So we've just spent the first section of this, the first 7 minutes, talking about what Wisdom and Money is. I would now love to maybe switch it a little bit and talk about who Rose Fearick is.
Yes. Yes, thank you. Sure. So I am somebody who grew up in a family and a culture that I would now think of as a wealthy community. And at the time, I didn't. We called it upper middle class, but now I would say, no, it's a wealthy community. So I grew up in a family where we had resources were abundantly met. I'm one of 6 children, Irish Catholic family, suburbs of New York. And also, it's a family that took faith very seriously. And so my parents are both people who often go to mass every day, things like that. And what's interesting is that we lived in this wealthy community because my parents had a big value on education. And so they moved there because of the schools. But they are not people who are particularly materialistic. And so if you can imagine, we were living in a wealthy community where people had very nice clothing and cars and things like that. And my parents certainly had the ability to purchase those things, but it really just didn't occur to them because those are not things they care about. And so, but as a kid growing up in that environment, it was sort of a paradoxical sensation. You know, as a kid, we wanted to be kind of hip with the friends, but we always had hand-me-down clothing, and my parents always drove what we'd think of as like an economy car. And so it was a little embarrassing. So it was this very paradoxical upbringing, and yet very steeped in the Catholic tradition in my family. And so that's my context of growing up. But I definitely have the benefits of not worrying about money and having very good education all the way through college. And so that was just what came from my family context. But I came to the conversation about money because I went to a university in which, again, spiritual values were very much part of the education. And I just remember the first day I showed up, it's a Jesuit school. Jesuits are a type of Catholic priest. And the Jesuit said to us, you know, from those to whom much has been given, much will be expected. And so he was really encouraging us to get involved in the local community, saying, you guys are here at this great university. You need to like figure out how you can be of service to the community that we're in. So I just say that to say that was like day one of my college education. And I did that. And I started working with women who were pregnant, who were trying to get good health care and housing. And this was in a city where the infant mortality rate was the highest in the country. So it was really mattered to support women who were trying to have healthy pregnancies and get, you know, just get their needs met. So I would do that every week. And then I would go back to my wealthy university, where if I talked to my peers, what people would often say was their intention in life was to make a lot of money. And I just thought, wait a second. All right. Isn't it supposed to be about something else? And I don't know why it was that, you know, just how I was made, but also the family background made me think that spiritual values mattered. And so to just have as my only goal in life to make a lot of money, that just didn't make sense to me. I thought, isn't life more than that? So here I am, idealistic college student, graduate. I'm committed to continuing to work in communities this was in Washington, D.C. And so a lot of activist communities and communities trying to respond to needs of people who just were trying to get their basic needs met. And I've made a decision, a very conscious decision, to simplify my lifestyle. I knew I'd come from this background of wealth, trying to be part of a movement of social justice. How do I learn how to live more simply myself? I wasn't trying to dictate anybody else, just right here. And it was just as I was making that decision that I learned that my family had set aside money for me from the time I was young. And there was this financial portfolio that had my name on it. And I was now 21. And they basically gave it to me to manage. And I was like, what? Here I'm like choosing to simplify. And then I'm handed this, you know, paper printout of a fidelity statement, which indicates a very big number at the bottom, big for 21. And I thought, this is exactly what I'm trying not to do. So it was a paradox. And that's how I got into this work with money, because I was somebody who cared about social justice. And yet, what do you do if you're someone who has received, you know, in my case, it was received money through my family, but maybe it's through marriage, or maybe it's your job just takes off. Like, but I was somebody who cared about social justice, and how do I work with that? So I came into Wisdom and Money, these kind of circles, because I needed that circle. I needed people who understood this question. And I have to say, the world that I came from was not a world where I knew people who had these questions. Really, that was a world where the script was to accumulate wealth. And receiving a financial portfolio at 21, that's like hitting the jackpot. That's great news. But for me, who cared about social justice, who cared about trying to living in solidarity, that it was a paradox I didn't know how to work with. So that's how I come into these conversations about money. And it's been, gosh, maybe 30 years that I've been sitting in circles looking at this. And initially I thought, you know, let me go away for a weekend, get some teaching, figure it out, implement it, and I'll have it down. But it's what I learned is that money is complex, and it touches into a lot of other dimensions of life. And so we also say in Wisdom and Money that it's just the tip of the iceberg. Meaning, if you start to look at money and how it's flowing in your life and just all the emotions or feelings or constrictions or questions that come up related to money, in fact, what you're looking at is your whole life. So if you're interested in money and really attend to it as a spiritual practice, it's a very rich and deep way of looking at how do I really live what I say I believe. And so that's what we're trying to do in Wisdom and Money, is trying to create those spaces where no judgment, just compassionate holding of one another as we're trying to live into our values in the, you know, by working with money. So I'm part of this work because it was the work that I needed because of the challenge that I was handed when I was 21.
Yeah. I mean, that sounds like so many healers, right? You go into it looking to heal yourself, and next thing you know, you're like, wow, this is actually a place where I can add something, where, and it became continuous healing for yourself too. Yeah.
Right. And that's also why I say it's a peer network. It's because I too need friends as I continue to walk this journey with money, which, you know, every chapter of life, it's the next challenge or the next opportunity, you could say, that presents related to money, just because of how our lives, just how things unfold. Yeah.
Yeah. I remember reading that it's one of our longest relationships, right? From the moment that you realize what money is, you might be what, 6, 7 years old, until you lose cognitive capacity, right? Money is there. Money's something you think about. It's food, exercise. It's one of those things that's just day in, day out. We're making decisions, not to make it burdensome, but just to say how pervasive it is, really.
Right. Right. Yeah. And I mean, just like any relationship, if our relationship with it is in sync with who we are and our own, in our case, it's with our spiritual values, then it can really be a wonderful, life-giving relationship, but it can be the opposite as well. So again, that's why I just think of it as a great practice place.
Mm-hmm. And this podcast is also for people who consider themselves to be highly sensitive. And yes. I remember when I first brought this concept to you, when I my first experience of the term highly sensitive I shared was negative. Like I thought that sounded weak, you know, sensitive. I don't want to be sensitive. And I loved hearing from you that you actually heard it as a positive thing. Like how does sensitivity to you sound positive? I mean, and just full disclosure, like it does feel positive to me now, but the initial reaction was not positive.
Yeah, it's funny because I was almost the exact opposite of you. I tend to experience the word sensitive as a plus, meaning, so the way I hear it, I mean, you and I have talked about what the highly sensitive means in this context, but the way I initially heard it was sort of almost like if you said somebody was highly intuitive, meaning they have a capacity to sense or lean into experiences that perhaps are more subtle for others. And for me, as I'm in the world of spirituality, in the world of deep listening, people who have increased capacities for those kinds of things, that's a plus. So, because we're very interested in sort of the deep experience of life in Wisdom and Money. I know in some other contexts, perhaps what's valued is productivity and efficiency. Here, I'd say what I value is just being able to tune in what's happening inside of me, what's happening around me. And so when you described highly sensitive, I thought, oh, these are people who have their radar for perceiving what's going on around us is more attuned than others who might be a little desensitized. So it just, that's why I thought it was a plus. It was like, oh, you have a stronger ability to pick up on what's happening in a room, or to even, I know sometimes for some people, noise can be a challenge. And I'm somebody who is drawn to silence. And so I'm like, yeah, I get that, because sometimes it's the deep silence that allows for like a relaxed state in which another part of us can open and listen. And so I wouldn't necessarily see it a problem at all that somebody, you know, has a challenge when there's a lot of noise in a room, because I would tend to assume that person is listening on another level, is hearing more, rather than if you're able to tolerate a lot of noise, you probably have an ability to tune out a lot just to function. I don't know that that's actually how the research is, but I'm just saying that's why, for me, highly sensitive, I thought, oh, these are folks who, the best way for me to think of it is like your radar or your intuition or your abilities just receive more information from the environment. And that's a great thing in my view. Now, I know the world is not always set up that way.
When you think about the statistics, it's about 15 to 30% of the population that falls under highly sensitive, which means that 70 to 85% of the population is not. And that can be what causes conflict.
Right. And I'm not in any way denigrating like people who orient differently, but I think I just tend to assume that in any community, there's people have different abilities, different gifts. And so my assumption is if you're working with someone, like if you're highly sensitive, chances are there's particular gifts that are there. I'd be curious to know what you see them as, like for an individual, if I was talking to you. And then if I'm in a community of people, we want to have a space where the gifts of all people can show up and be received. Now, our culture, I know, can be dominated by that 70%. I'm just saying for me, I just would assume if somebody has a difference in some way, there's got to be a gift in there. And how do we know what it is and receive it? So that anyway, that's why for me, I didn't think it was a negative on first hearing. I thought it was like, great. We want people in the room who are more attuned. That's awesome.
I was thrilled when I heard that because it was, again, such a different response to my initial reaction to the term. Mm-hmm. Now on the other side of it, it's been a couple of years that I identified as highly sensitive. I now see how beneficial it is to know myself more clearly, to know like what is it that I need, how much silence, how much time with others, how much stimulation.
Yeah.
So that's been really helpful.
Yes.
The third leg of this podcast is social justice. Mm-hmm. And I remember you shared a story with us once about being a kid and your parents being really adamant about helping whenever there was some kind of food drive.
Yes. So I spoke earlier about my family upbringing and some of the values that came through that for my parents were rooted in their spiritual commitments. And so one way that got expressed was that so I went to a school where certain times of the year, they would do a collection for maybe around Thanksgiving for canned food or things like that. I think many of us have seen those kinds of drives. And in my family, when that notice came out, we would do a special shopping trip to the grocery store and load up the back of the car with all of the bags of groceries and deliver them. And that was just how it went in my family. And it was, you know, on one level, a little mortifying as a kid who wants to fit in, like everybody else is bringing their three cans and we have to have that's the day we get driven to school to unload the bags of groceries. And it was just not a big deal for my mom. It was just, that's what you do. And so that ethic that when there is a call put out to respond to needs of people in the community who may be having food insecurity, that's how we responded in my family. So that really communicated something to me about just what it means to, like, if somebody has an abundance of one thing and somebody else doesn't have, it's part of that flow. It's not a, oh, great, I've got more than you kind of thing. It's like, oh, no. So if there's a need here and we have more than we need, then we respond abundantly. So I think that was the beginning of an understanding of generosity, I would say. That was just as a way of being, as well as a critical part of what it meant to live our spiritual values. So that was one part of it. Meanwhile, my father is an attorney, and a big part of his work, like he would come to the dinner table on Sundays. We would have a family dinner on Sunday nights, and he's the kind of guy who would like pose an ethical dilemma for us at the table that we would all have to have a debate around. But a lot of those dilemmas were about justice, social justice, ethics, integrity. And so that sense of justice was also there in my family. And so in in my understanding of social justice, it's like there's two sides. Like, we absolutely need to respond to the needs that people have today. If somebody's hungry today, that's a critical thing that we need to respond to. At the same time, we want to look at what's going on, that there's so many people who are hungry. That's another side of social justice, of looking at what's causing this situation that we're seeing. So I give that example of my mom and my dad because it really holds these two dimensions of how I learned how to look through the lens of social justice, not just what are the present needs, but what's happening systemically that's resulting in people not having adequate housing, people having to flee their home to look for another place to live, people not being able to eat, so many people of certain skin color showing up in prison. Like, what is that? What's causing that? Looking for those causes is a key dimension of social justice that I learned in our Sunday evening debates with Dad, in addition to the Thanksgiving drive with Mom. So all of that was like just part of the background for me of learning about social justice. I've obviously in my adult life, I've learned a lot more, but that's the root of it.
Yeah. And now, because again, the work of Wisdom and Money is to help people of wealth make decisions through their mystical Christian heart. And often that can mean right sharing, right? What in Quakers we would call right sharing. What does it mean to have the right amount? And it's a different number. And it's not even so much a number as it is like, what is it that you're trying to have? What is trying to live through you? I guess, again, those would be Quaker ways of saying it. Now, as a facilitator at Wisdom and Money, how do you help people who are looking at the question of social justice and money?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, so you mentioned a lot of things there that are quite core to Wisdom and Money and quite juicy. So the first is the mystical heart. What is that? What are we talking about? And also we talked earlier about the contemplative practices. Why are we doing those in a conversation about money? And the reason, first off, is that what we're trying to do is awaken a part of our being that for some people is, it just hasn't been awakened yet. And it's an ability of sight. It's an ability to see. It's a way of orienting that's rooted in a part of ourselves that is open, that doesn't see in terms of me or you, but sees in terms of us, that sees the whole. In some spaces, we call this non-dual seeing. And it's a very different way of orienting than how we typically first learn to orient, which is what we have to do to function in the world, which is me, you, us, them. That's what we call in contemplative world the egoic way of seeing. It's not a negative, not an ego, like pride kind of way. It just means it's just an ordinary dimension of consciousness.
But right. It's a it's a developmental stage.
Right. And an important one, right? But in the contemplative world, what we try and awaken is that human beings also have another ability, and that is this other way of being rooted in the heart. Now, let's go back to social justice. What does it have to do with that? So if I'm rooted there and I have a capacity to see the whole, then I don't see in terms of my tribe or your tribe. I have a greater ability to see the common good. So if somebody is coming to our work and they're interested in social justice, well, the way I sit with somebody, first off, I always just want to know, what is this person seeking? So I also really believe that the Holy Spirit works through each of us as us. So I'm never trying to make somebody something different from who they are, because I feel like it's a sacred thing who a person is. So the question is, how is this person's spirit trying to emerge in their lives and in service of love? And now, if somebody is moving in that way, and that love is that rooted in that non-dual seeing, it does create social justice, because there's no us and them. It's not, you feel the connection to others. There is no joy in my having a lot and someone else having a little. It just, it doesn't feel good when we're rooted in that place. So I'm just saying that I think justice, social justice in this way, comes out of a fundamental posture of open-heartedness. Now, that being said, there's also a lot of systems that are at work, like in our unconscious selves, that are come from the cultures that we live in. So racism, for example, most people I know do not seek to be racist. And yet sometimes we step into it because we have been trained in a culture that's racist. And so another thing that we do in Wisdom and Money is we really are so grateful for our partnership with Be Present, which has this amazing practice called the Be Present Empowerment Model, which there's so many dimensions of goodness that flow through this model. But one is it enables us to start to see how some of the culture scripts that are rooted in injustice, I mentioned racism, classism, ageism, misogyny, they operate in us.
Intellectualism, you know, the idea that only if it's intellectual knowledge, it's valid. And yet our body has knowledge, our heart has knowledge.
Exactly. Exactly. And so, you know, basically the goal is to bring all of our ways of knowing our wisdom online so that we can make choices about money that really are rooted in that. Now, of course, many people know that often what happens when I'm, and maybe not for you, Deanna, because you're so skillful and brilliant with money. But for many people, when we open the spreadsheet or we look at our bank account, there can be a whole lot of experiences that happen. So maybe it's, oh, look at me, I'm doing so good. And like maybe there's like a puffed upness, or maybe there's a panic, you know, there's not enough. Or maybe it's, I just never open my bank account because I'm scared to look at money. I mean, there can be any number. Or maybe it's just this feeling of huge burden of what do I even do with this? There's a lot of sensations that can happen. So remember, what we were talking about was getting rooted in our inner wisdom, in our open-heartedness. So when we make decisions about money, it comes from there. But usually there's a journey to get from our place of panic or stress or whatever to the place where I know how to like settle in, open, listen, and then see what money decision can flow. You know, one other thing, just speaking about social justice. So Wisdom and Money is, in our mission, we say that we're rooted in the wisdom and prophetic dimensions of Christianity. And so the prophetic, what is that? That is a particular part of Christianity. And I want to be clear, there's so many different things that might come up when I say the word Christianity. And the reason we're saying we're in the wisdom and prophetic is we're really trying to identify the particular Christianity that we're coming from. We're not part of any church. But the wisdom is the contemplative, which we've talked about. The prophetic is really a dimension of Christianity which works for social change. So in other words, we understand that it's part of the biblical tradition. It's part of the wisdom that comes from Christianity in every moment of time to be seeing how our culture is not honoring humans, is not honoring the earth, and try to change that. That is the prophetic dimension of Christianity. So you probably know amazing humans, Martin Luther King, Dorothy Day, Oscar Romero, people who have deeply Christian people really working for change in their context. That's what we mean there. So often in Wisdom and Money, we find amazing people who come to our work, who have a vision of change in their context. And all I want to do is get behind them. So what I mean is help them to understand their own vision and help them to live it. So that's really what I'm doing. Remember, as their friend, as their partner.
Mm-hmm. As their peer.
Right. And so, I mean, I've heard some of the amazing things you want to do in terms of supporting a much wider group of people to have the tools of financial knowledge available to them. That's an incredible vision. That's changing how the system is set up. So when I hear these things that people share with me, I'm just excited. And I just really want to say, yes, go do that thing. And how can we help you to do that well? So that's the kind of community it is in Wisdom mm-hmm. and Money. But what sometimes go ahead.
And it's so important to have that community part of it too. One of the things that I talk about when I'm teaching about money is that when we're changing who we are or how we do something, unless there's others around us who are also in the middle of that change, we can end up having a lot of gaslighting, a lot of pushback, which is normal. Right. It's not personal. It's just like if, for example, I decide to become vegetarian or vegan because of animal welfare and the environment, and my partner loves to eat steak, like there's going to be some conversations that are going to come up. It's not personal. It's something to navigate. And having a group of other vegans that I can go and like, how did you manage this? You know, that's so helpful. Like one of my favorite quotes is by bell hooks that rarely, if ever, is anyone that's healed in isolation. Healing is an act of communion. Change is best done with friends.
Right. And I, you know, in our work with money, remember what we're inviting people to do is to step outside of business as usual and to do something different that really is rooted in their own vision and heart. Now, what happens when we start to do that? I mean, I'll just speak from my experience. I've named that I grew up in a particular suburban culture, and I've had this other vision emerge in my life. So as I start to make choices from that, which, for example, has involved not pursuing wealth accumulation as a path, that would be normal in the world that I came from. There's some voices that come up that are from the culture I grew up in. Voices like, what's wrong with you? Like, you know, how come, man, I really thought you had a lot going for you, but what happened in your life? You know, things, voices like that. And I can start to evaluate myself from the lens of the very culture that I'm walking out of. That's common. Those are my examples, but that's common for many people. But meanwhile, here's this other way of being that I'm walking towards. And so it's really helpful to have friends who are saying, come on, this way, keep going. Because there is an inner as well as an outer pushback that can happen when we're shifting from a conventional way of thinking about money to one that's rooted in the heart, that's rooted in spirit, that really cares about all people. So I think we can expect that. And then the key is how to have a friends who just keeps seeing what we're seeing and encouraging us to keep moving towards it. Because we are talking about a root level shift of how money flows. So that's not a small thing.
And I'm thinking about it. So you mentioned the Be Present empowerment model. One of my favorite parts of it is that it's meant to be done in groups, the way that I've experienced it, right? That there's someone there who is seeing me in my wholeness,
right?
Even when I'm experiencing that internal pushback,
right?
When I'm thinking, my parents immigrated to this country so that I could have a better life. And here I am not trying to maximize my income. And also the guilt that can, I mean, what I'm mentioning there is guilt, is expectations, the fear,
right?
And holding me as like, here is the vision of what I have.
Yes, definitely. Holding us in our vision, even when we forget it. There's something to have friends who have seen our brilliance and just keep our eye on that is critical. And here's another fun thing. So again, in Wisdom and Money, we work with people of wealth and the culture of wealth. And there's learned behaviors that come from that. They're just habits. They're ways of being that really make a lot of sense in the world of wealth that I come from. And I might bring them over into my new community, not realizing I'm doing something that's offensive because it's a blind spot that I have. And so the Be Present learning, one of the things it's taught me is in those moments where somebody's behavior is off, we still hold that vision of brilliance of that person and we slow them down until I or you or whoever it is can see for ourselves that what I just did is not consistent with what I say I want to be about in the world. So that's very different from, you know, like a calling out kind of approach. It's a, we I would call it more of a slowing down approach. When somebody's behavior is off, we slow them down to sort of just look at what just happened. But that slowing down is rooted in the honoring of the person's spirit. So this practice from Be Present is such a gift, especially for people of wealth who can often reinforce some pretty funky stuff that's going on in the culture. I mean, all of us can, but people of wealth have a particular way we might have learned to engage in like power over behavior or whatever it might be. And so, I mean, in Wisdom and Money, that's another thing. We would expect inner voices might show up, but there might even be some behaviors that show up that we have to slow down and say, hey, let's look at that and see what that is. Compassion, holding of the person's spirit. And again, for the person to see for themselves, because it's actually only when I see it for myself, what I'm doing, mm-hmm. that's where the change comes from. For somebody to tell me, oh, this terrible thing you're doing, that it doesn't help me change. What changes is when somebody asks me a question that enables me to see it. And then I'm like, whoa, right. I had no idea what I was doing was like causing this impact for someone else. So that's another dimension of social justice, is having our actions be the justice that we're seeking.
Having our actions be an integrity from the place that right. we're moving. Yeah, from where we're making decisions.
Right. Right. But also having friends who very compassionately, but in a committed way, slow us down when our actions are off. Yeah. So that's also part of social justice.
One of the very concrete personal examples that I can share about the impact of Wisdom and Money on me is that for me, I'm very much like, I have a very caretaking personality on the Enneagram. I'm a type 2. So I love being of service. I love helping others. I see so much potential. The negative side of that is that I can become so driven by seeing other people reach their potential, which means I forget about myself, or I lord it over them, right? Like, here, this is all I'm sacrificing for you. And in Wisdom and Money, I saw how I was afraid of, I didn't include myself and well-being. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. And it was very, I remember at one of our circles, I think it was last June, so June 2023, where I was recognizing how burnt out and stressed out I was from just being an entrepreneur and being a digital nomad. And it's such a subtle change, the holding, the contemplative holding, and also the continuous holding of the prophetic vision. Because for myself, one of the things that I struggle with is despondency, right? Being like, the problems are so big.
Right.
Who am I to think I can do any kind of change on this? And yet here's this community that's like, there's liberation theology. That's a huge part of Latin American culture. There's Dorothy Day. There's a lot of positive things to hold on to. And there's been positive changes. And in that particular retreat at Wisdom and Money, I saw for the first time how I was not really including myself.
Yeah.
How I would remind other people to take care of themselves, but I wasn't doing it. And it's been very life-giving to allow more rest into my life.
Yeah.
And you might say, what does that have to do with money? But by me changing, right, by me remembering to hold myself, then I'm much less likely to act out my anger or my exhaustion right. through other people.
Right.
Right. And this is a concept that I remember learning through Resmaa Menakem. He wrote My Grandmother's Hands. He talks a lot about how our body holds racism, mm-hmm. which is what you were talking about, right? These behaviors, these power over. I remember there's this beautiful blog where Stephen Bonsi, yeah. who was a former co-director of Wisdom and Money, where he's talking about, he's at a presentation. And maybe do you remember what the story is? Would you mind sharing it?
Right. what I remember, we were at a Wisdom and Money gathering, and he and another person who was part of our board had together come up with a presentation, how they were going to present the financial numbers. And it was, our treasurer at the time was a woman of color. And so Stephen and the treasurer, they were working together on this. And in the midst of the conversation, there was a question that came from somebody else on the board who happened to be a white man. And Stephen did was he jumped in there, changed the presentation, went off on some other approach that in his mind made sense in the world of white men, but he completely forgot about the presentation that he and his partner had set up and, you know, what her role was in it. And it was one of those learned behaviors that he wrote about it because he came to see it, because we slowed him down to see what just happened to him. Like, why did he do that? What was going on? And it's a powerful moment where we have an opportunity not to, it's not really coming from a place of jumping up and judging someone for doing that, because what we're looking for is a shift. So it's a slowing him down to see what has just happened and to see why that has an impact on his partner, and then to give him the opportunity to see it so then in the future he can choose something else. He did that, which is why he then wrote that blog, is because he came to an understanding of, wow, look at how quick that behavior jumped in. And again, you know, it was like a learned way of being, but the community is trying to learn a different way of being. And that's where, again, it's just so helpful to have friends where it's coming from a place of partnership and compassionate understanding that we are all inside of a system that none of us created. So our work is to try to uproot where that system, its unhealthy dimensions, are at work in us, and to support each other along that way. So that is one of the ways that we work for social justice, is by finding those shards of injustice in ourselves. And, you know, one of the amazing places I've worked at the point of money is, you know, just finding my voice when I talk to financial professionals. I don't have a finance background. And I think I somehow along the way learned that, you know, understanding things like mutual funds and stocks and bonds was things that men did. And so when I would, you know, it was very scary for me to call somebody who was a financial advisor and just have a conversation with them. It was a place where I had internalized something of my own not having a voice. Like, nobody was doing that to me. That was in me. And yet, through the supportive community, knowing, you know, I'm a perfectly intelligent person and I don't have a finance background, but this person does. And so therefore they can help me to understand something. Like, instead of going quiet because it's not my area of expertise, saying, wow, isn't that awesome that you have that? How can I ask questions so you can help me understand? It's a much more empowered place.
Yeah.
But that is another place where some of like the culture's stories about women in that case had gotten in my own head, so that I forgot, you know, I'm perfectly intelligent. I'm not telling anybody that I know anything about finance, but I can understand if somebody explains something to me.
Right.
So it's really different for each person. So this is like where I'm just saying, these are places where I've seen it at work in me. And then the question is, like, once I see it, then it's my responsibility to shift it. The focus of my work is less about going after some abstract something out there to working to shift it right here. And then once I've been able to shift, my actions are going to be different. And now I'm part of a movement of social justice. So that's a big part of our practice, I would say.
And going back to the example I was sharing about recognizing that I wasn't including myself in the whole of well-being, what that was creating in me was this, I would say no to workaholism and I would do workaholism.
Right.
Right. So there was this clash of, there was not integrity, there was dissonance that was happening. And because when I asked you to bring in Steve's story, I asked, like, well, what does this have to do with money? Well, I'm a money coach for women of color entrepreneurs. If I have an underground story that's telling me that workaholism is okay, right, what am I going to tell my clients?
Exactly. Exactly. Right. 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 And of course, there's also that powerful thing of our actions are much more effective teachers than whatever words we say. So even if you said the right words, if you embody this self-care, healthy way of being in your work, that is just going to communicate on another level. So there's that part too. But yeah, it's profound. And even like, what's the message that led to you feeling a need to work that hard? You know, those are all powerful places of inquiry, and, you know, possible to shift.
Yeah. And again, this conversation, it's really like what happens in Wisdom and Money. It is these spaces of inquiry. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's, I remember, so I've been with my therapist for 4 years, and she's always telling me that when we're changing these very underground things, it's a very slight shifting. I remember she used this metaphor of like shifting wheels in a clock, and you just have to do it really finely because there's so many things that are interconnected. Yes. And it's learning a new way of being. And it's also honoring like what's good about my work ethic,
yeah,
right? What has been good? What has been life-giving? And where am I interested now in shifting towards something that's more life-giving, that's more right, in line with the world that I want to see.
Right, right. And those kinds of questions of what is it that gave rise to that need to work so hard and what is the gift of your work ethic, those are all, I mean, that whole way of holding it as an open question so you can find the answers to those questions. I actually don't ever know what it is in another person that needs to shift. So the space is really just a space for the person to talk, to explore, to be held until that person sees what's going on for themselves. Because often the same external actions are not coming from the same internal story. So if we're seeking a shift outwardly, in Wisdom and Money, what we're trying to do is create a community space where the person can be inside of their own inner inquiry, find what's the root of that behavior, and really with great compassion begin to shift it. That's the style of change that we're working on. And it's a different approach than what people might experience in other contexts. And to go back to what I said at the beginning, it makes sense for some people who are really looking for the inner source of some of the actions that perhaps are not aligned with where we would like to be, but in a space that's holding them. So it's not mm-hmm. judging, it's just holding open, so each of us can find those places and relax them, let them go when we're ready.
Right. See how they transform when we give them attention. Yeah. Right. And one of them, so like, it makes a lot of sense that All the Colors, the coaching that I do, and also my work with Strategy Squad is well rooted in Wisdom and Money, because I focus a lot on very like the personal, the internal.
Yeah.
And one of the conflicts that happens in me is like, I should be doing policy advocacy. I should be doing something that's much bigger and grander and like right, makes a more concrete change. When people bring that to you, or is that a question that people bring to you at Wisdom and Money?
Yeah, I mean, I think it comes up. And I would say if, you know, a lot of, because my background is in the world of spirituality, I think in terms of vocation, meaning each person's personal mission. And there are people for whom their work in this world is policy. And so if that were you, I would just be supporting you to do that thing. But again, I'm only ever listening for what is the thing that you really feel called to, trusting that each of us has our particular place in the system of, in the shift that we're trying to seek. And it's like, all you have to do is the one thing that's yours to do, and to do it well, do it with joy, full heart. So that's my orientation. But now some people are called to work at a macro level, and then that is their work, but not all people are. Now, let's say you're not, but you still have that as like a haunting voice. I just would want to know, what is that voice? You know, why? Like, what is the reason that somehow a sense of value has to do with policy or, you know, I don't know what it is. I don't want to presume. But sometimes there can be things that come out of our culture. Like, again, it's like we're in a culture where more is better. You know, you see that economically. And I don't know that that's true. Sometimes deeper is better. Sometimes being the most amazing mom in your family is the best gift you can give in this world. And so I think I would just look at it through the lens of vocation. So I'm always listening to people, like what they're telling me is the thing they are seeking for their lives. If just imagine if we had a world where all people did that and really were oriented towards, and when I say what they're meant to be doing in their lives, I really mean from that place of open-hearted, grounded in spirit place. Mm-hmm. I think we have a different world. So that's, now policy questions are so important. They are. And so if that is your place, then yeah. I'm just going to be like, yeah, go do that thing.
Yeah, that's true. And the question that you asked, like, what in me is putting down the one-to-one to work and saying the macro is better. And it sounds very, as I say it out loud, I'm like, oh, that does sound like our culture. Our culture definitely does value the bigger, the more, the flashier, the instant gratification. Right. I remember reading like a list of like, what are the traits of white supremacy culture? And it was individualism. It was avoiding conflict. It was immediacy. It was all of these different things right. that are part of the system that can feel so toxic, right? So again, it's holding myself outside of the distress of these oppressive noises.
Right. Yeah. And I, again, for me, it's a genuine question, like, where does that come from? Because, you know, if you had a persistent kind of question, like, oh, I feel like maybe I should work, I would also then say, let's look at it. Mm-hmm. Let's see what it is.
Okay. So I'm willing to go into it. I mean, I do coaching live. I could be spiritual directioned live because Rose Spirit is a spiritual director in addition to her other many, many roles. I think some of it is, as a highly sensitive person, and I shared this in one of the other podcasts for this first season, but I have a hard time with the news. I have a hard time staying abreast of current events. I can read the paper and spend 3 days crying.
Yeah.
Not useful for me, for the stories that I'm reading. I would much rather, like, one of the things that I'm doing right now, specifically with like the ongoing crisis in Gaza and Palestine, I have a dear friend who works that space. Yes. And I send her love. I send her messages. I don't consume a lot of news about it. And I carry this guilt of like, I should know more. And yet when I do know more, I just cry more.
Yeah. I mean, that's a really, really tender place, isn't it? And yeah, I'm just slowing down because I know the war in Gaza is very, it's painful, you know? So on one level, the tears are real. What is happening. And it's a good point that, you know, there is a place for the grief, but there's also something that can happen with our media that kind of keeps us stuck in all the terribleness. And that, too, can prevent us from doing the things that are ours to do. So it's a tricky place because it is, you know, I think it's important to know what's happening in the world. And yet it's also important to find the ways where we can be in response from love. So it sounds like you have found that, you know, of what, how is it that you know what's happening in Gaza? How is it that you can respond? I think that's wise. And I also, I mean, I really appreciate what you're saying, that as somebody who's highly sensitive, taking in too much news can be paralyzing. So that's good to know, you know, what is the right way to inform yourself and then how to let go of that which just keeps you stuck, because we don't want stuck, right? That's a really good point for folks who are working with highly sensitive nature, that it's just, yeah, it's good to know, like, what enables you to keep walking.
And that's where the focus on the macro keeps coming. You know, like you should be able to hold the macro more than you than I can.
Yeah.
And at this point in my life, I'm like, this is actually what's working, right? And it's true. Like the grief is real.
I guess it's where I come back to the whole notion of vocation. Like I really think each of us, my wish and prayer is that each of us finds whatever the unique way that you can be of service in this world. By of service, I mean be part of creating goodness, be creating a world where all people are cared for, and do that thing. Just, you know, do our little piece. One of the other dimensions of contemplative practice that happens is it can, that shift from the egoic operating system to the mystical heart, it's also a shift of humility. Like there's a place where we come to an understanding of I'm just one person, and I am one person. So I need to be me, I need to do me in the world, but I'm not, you know, I don't need to fix the world. So it's like a place of like understanding ourselves as part of the earth instead of whatever, the God of the earth, and just but playing our part and playing it well and hopefully with some joy.
Yeah, there's this quote I remember hearing, I don't know who it's by, but to that Buddhists say to sweep as if the world depended on it.
Right.
All the time laughing at yourself for thinking any of it matters. And holding that paradox of like, here is the work that I'm going to do. I'm going to cook this meal for my family and it's going to be filled with love and we're going to have a good, joyous time together. And we don't know how long we have to live.
Right. Right.
We don't know whether our family members are well, you know, and holding that paradox and being like, again, another thing that I remind myself all the time is like, this belongs, like whatever feeling is coming up, whatever thought, notion, it belongs. It's here to give me guidance.
And
we often don't bring that to money at all. Which is again, why a space like Wisdom and Money is, it's such a sweet place to be. It's such a treat.
Yes. And your work.
Thank you. Like a true mentor, reminding me to also take in positivity. My last question, the question that I would love to close on, is where do you go to seek refuge whenever you feel a sense of overwhelm, whenever you feel a sense of like needing to be held up? What practices do you have? Where do you go, or who do you go to?
Well, Deanna knows that I have this phrase of, what are the conditions in which Rose does well? And
under which Rose thrives.
yes. The conditions in which Rose thrives. Well, so for me, I come from people who for many generations lived near the ocean. And I didn't grow up near the ocean, but I discovered in my early 30s that really communities that live or walking on the beach is really my home. And what I mean by that is it's a place where I just feel most me. And so I tend to spend times partly in New York, partly in California. So I live in states where there are oceans. And so I make a practice of getting there. But sometimes I'm not near an ocean. And in that case, it's really, I just find some place in nature. So being outside, being in nature is always very nurturing for me. And typically, you know, there's a way I might do some exercise listening to a podcast like this or a book on tape, and I'm sort of out there for the exercise part. But if I have gotten myself dysregulated and I'm wanting to reset my nervous system, then I'm turning everything off and I'm just really allowing myself to receive through the earth. So that's a place that's always very helpful to me. And I don't mean like one walk, but like if I've gotten dysregulated, then I'm like, oh, I need to have a morning walk every day until I've sort of reset myself. Quiet for me is also really helpful. I spend time in a monastery on the Big Sur coast from time to time, and it's just amazing how when I'm there, I usually the first day I just sleep, and then after a couple days of being in this place of quiet, there's really very little stimulation. I just feel myself. So when I've re-regulated, that's the quality of it, is I feel, it doesn't even feel like a big deal. It just, here I am, I'm back in myself. Nature, quiet, solitude, those are really good places for me. And in other moments, it's the community of people who really know me. I'm very fortunate because in Wisdom and Money, we've spent so much time building this kind of authentic community. But coming back to people who just know me, where I don't have to work, you know, hard to put on anything, that can really also help me to reground myself. But most typically, it's very funny, the people in my family, they know that if I start getting a little crotchety, scratchy around the edges, they'll be like, I think you need to take a day, go to the beach, go take a retreat. Another thing I do sometimes is I take a bath, warm water, find a bathhouse. And yeah, so my kids, when they were little, they were like, is it time for you to go to the bathhouse? They didn't mean that I was dirty. They meant that I needed to take an hour of just that kind of body care. So I have learned those kinds of things. But in general, the conditions in which I do well is in a place near nature with some spaciousness to the day so I can have the quiet time beginning or end of day. It's very simple, really, for me. I think what's key is for each person to know what those things are for you, because they're different. You know, we come from mm-hmm. different lineages. Like my dad grew up in the Bronx, and he really feels most comfortable in the city. That's not true for me, but that is true for him. And so I think it's that, like, what are the places I've said where I feel at home, where I feel myself. I think that's a good question for each of us who are, you know, doing work or just are sensitive to life, to know what those places are, so that when hopefully they're in our lives in a regular way, but if we do find ourselves dysregulated or just needing to reset, we know where to go. That's what it is for me. But
yeah, and it's not that you're, I think when we got dysregulated, at least for me, sometimes I can be like, what did I do wrong that I feel dysregulated? And it's like, no, that's just part of, you know, it's life. Like sometimes you need a reset. You know, you got to turn it off, turn it back on, and it just comes back fresher.
Yeah. And I mean, life happens. There's hard things that happen, you know, and we need to, I think, you know, in Be Present, we say a lot to know where you are, and by which means, am I, like, first step is, do I even realize I'm dysregulated? Right. Mm-hmm. You know, like and then know what to do if I find I am. Yeah.
Yeah. And one of the really, I ask this question because as a change maker, as someone who wants to, maybe is following the prophetic vision, although I never thought of it that way before, when we're coming from a place that's dysregulated, all we're going to create is dysregulation.
Right.
It's very hard to create peace when all you feel inside is war.
Right.
Right. So the invitation to regulation is not just so that you can be good for others, which again, here, Enneagram 2, reminding myself of that, but because I also want to live a life that's regulated, right, that's peaceful.
Right.
A lot of the, and yes, I love the invitation to just know, like, what does it look like for you to become regulated? And how do you know when it's time to go and take a bath? Right. For myself, it's journaling. I try and journal as much as possible because that's what slows me down to mm-hmm. see what's happening, to see what I may need.
Right. Yeah.
Well, it's been a joy. Thank you so much, yes. Rose.
Likewise, always. I'm, as I said at the beginning, I'm just very huge fan of what you're trying to be about and create in the world. So happy to be a part of it.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure to have you on as my first money expert who focuses on social justice on this podcast. And it's a joy to have you here. Thank you, Rose.
Thanks, Deanna.
Thank you for joining us today. I'm your host, Diana Giselle Yáñez. Did you enjoy this episode? Please share this first season of Highly Sensitive Money with others. To learn how you can upskill your money relationship, join the newsletter over at allthecolors.net. That's allthecolors.net for network. Take care, and remember, you've got what it takes to feel good about your money.